there, and welcome to Musings on Golf, where we're talking about an unprecedented day in our sport as two PGA Tour executives were questioned for 3 hours by the Senate Permanent Subcommittee on Investigations in Washington in regards to a potential alliance between the PGA Tour and the Public Investment Fund that is the backer of LIV Golf. I'm Kelly Elbin, along with Bob Bupka. Bob, it's complicated. It's something I don't think I ever thought I would see of having golf before a committee like this. But I thought Ron Price, the chief operating officer, said it succinctly early on. He said, only because of LIV that we are seated here today. Again, Bob, when the decision was made by the Saudis to get involved in golf, for whatever reason, it changed everything.
First off, I want to begin by I've never felt more disappointed in being able to address our many, many, many listeners of Musings on Golf to come up with some answers. I watched for 3 hours. I was bitterly disappointed in a couple of things. Number one, there was never, ever a mention of volunteers at these professional golf tournaments. They talk about billions of dollars and millions of dollars and this and that and the other thing. And none of that could ever be achieved unless they had volunteers. 1,500, 2,000 roughly every week. And I was hurt by that. And number two, the constant misrepresentation by senators in addressing the PGA Tour, but referencing PGA. I mean, what does it take for people to understand that there are two distinct organizations in golf? One is the PGA of America. Two is the PGA Tour. They're not the same, but boy, oh boy, does the, whenever you have discussions with PGA Tour officials and whatnot, you hear PGA come into the conversation. It's just not fair.
And having worked at the PGA of America for about a dozen years, I can relate, sympathize with that. My dad was a longtime PGA member, and I know the PGA of America has tried very hard at the national level, at their section level, and at the grassroots level among their professionals to try to distinguish and explain the difference. But it's very much a catch-all of PGA. It's unique, right? It just doesn't exist in any other major sports organization. And so I feel for the PGA. Bob, about all we know in this is that the lawsuits which had cost the PGA Tour in particular a lot of money have been settled. But there are still so many details to be worked through. I do wonder, I heard a couple of the senators talk about how much more challenging it's going to be now that so much more is in the open to try to get a deal done. And we saw some documents released today by that Senate subcommittee that talked about possible roles that LIV hoped that Rory and Tiger would play and owning and playing on LIV teams. There's so many tentacles to this, Bob. I do wonder if a deal doesn't get done, where do we go?
Yeah, that's really a good question. I think if a deal doesn't get done, LIV is going to continue to grow. Money talks. We all know that. They can throw enough money at PGA Tour players and win them over. I mean, there's only about 25, real key players currently on the PGA Tour. And I'm not to demean the other players. I'm talking about the biggest stars, the 25 biggest stars on the PGA Tour.
The ones that really matter.
The others matter too, so I hesitate in saying that. But money, can buy them. I'm still amazed and have no answer for it. This is the longest since Tiger first came on the scene that we haven't heard a word from Tiger. It's been well over a month now. Not a word, not a peep, not a reaction, not a statement, not a position. I have no idea what is going on with Tiger Woods right now, And I'm not sure there are many people that do know.
Doesn't surprise me that we haven't heard from him. I just think that's consistent with who he's been through the years in matters of great importance. However, I think also that a concern here that people have is, okay, if the Saudis, again, they have never really explained why they have wanted to get involved in golf. But if they do, if they were to take over golf, what would be next? Would they have the resources? The answer is yes, to start a fledgling professional football league, let's say. And instead of the next wave of Tom Brady's and star defensive players who are playing in the NFL, instead of them making $30 million a year, what if they can make $100 million with this new league? Do they take over at some point? And there's no timeline here, Bob. Might be 5 years, might be 15 years. Do they take over the NFL? Do they take over the NBA? I think that's a real fear that people have, and I understand it.
Well, the reality of the situation, Kelly, is that if you have enough money and you want something, there's always a price. I mean, you know, nothing probably in reality is not up for sale. So, you know, when you're talking billions and billions and billions of dollars, you pretty much can get what you want. And they want to control professional golf. The PGA Tour doesn't want them to control professional golf. They've opted to try and form a partnership with, you know, the people that live. But the one stumbling block is going to be that LIV, I guarantee you, is going to insist that no PGA Tour member can say anything harsh about LIV. And for the PGA Tour to try and get their members to agree to that, I don't know if that's a mountain they can climb.
And that was something that Senator Blumenthal harped on extensively today. $700 billion is the value of that public investment fund. According to Ron Price, chief operating officer of the PGA Tour, their assets are $3 billion. So the math is pretty simple. Jimmy Dunn, I believe, is a good man. I believe that he has tried to do the right thing to, I think, really save the PGA Tour. I don't know how else to look at it. That if they hadn't begun a process to try to form an alliance, a deal, whatever you want to call it, I don't think it's a merger, but if they hadn't done it, I think he looked at the worst case scenario of these guys, the top players, continuing to be poached and the value of the PGA Tour just going down the drain.
I couldn't agree more with that statement, Kelly, but you know, I got to be perfectly candid to our listeners, and I always have been. I am not smart enough to really evaluate what is going on. I mean, people a lot smarter than me are scratching their head and raising their eyebrows. So I'm not going to make believe that I have the answers. I know it's going to be a rocky road ahead. Mm-hmm. I know that there's no agreement in place. You know, there's a framework which says that we're going to work towards an agreement. You know, which is the same thing as just saying we're working towards an agreement. And, you know, the framework thing carries little weight with me. So I don't know, but we got a great show, a show that I'm excited about, mm-hmm. A special, special guest that I think it's even going to amaze most of our listeners.
As we record this, we're just a little over a week away from the 151st Open at Royal Liverpool in England, and our guest today is Martin Slumbers, the CEO of the RNA. I was really impressed in talking with him, Bob. He has a great grasp on what's going on with the Open Championship and a lot of what they're trying to do to grow the game on the other side of the pond. And you hear from Martin in a little bit. You've covered a lot of major championships. You have to have a favorite Open. And by the way, the Open is your favorite event, but of all the Opens you've covered, one has to have stood out.
Well, it probably doesn't take a lot of thought on my part to conclude that favorite is Jack Nicklaus's last appearance at St. Andrews. And let me give you the background story. in that I was broadcasting from that yellow booth above the 18th hole, which was an honor and a thrill in itself. Never in a million years did I ever think I would be up in that position. And we were covering a lot of golf by monitors within the booth. I was assigned Tiger Woods, and Tiger was playing the back nine, and then all of a sudden, it had been decided before the program that when Jack finishes, they wanted me to go down to the 18th green to interview Jack. So I was in a little bit of a broadcast dilemma. Tiger was on 14, Jack was on 17. I said, good golly, what do I do now? So without saying anything to anybody in the booth, I just simply say, oh, ah, oh. And the lead announcer said, what's the matter, Bob? I said, oh, spectator stepped on my foot. I got to come into the booth. So immediately somebody else picked up covering Tiger Woods. I retreated to my position down alongside the 18th green to greet Jack. While I was there, a member of the RNA comes briskly walking towards me, and I was afraid, uh-oh, what did I do now? And he comes up and he says, is your foot feeling any better, Bob? And after that, I got to interview Jack. I put his wife, Barbara, on. I put his son, Gary, on. One of the proudest interviews that I've ever done.
That's pretty cool. And miraculously, that foot healed, right?
Amazingly so.
Well, we'll have a lot of stories that will be coming out from the 151st Open next week. And you're going to hear a lot as part of our extended preview of the Open from Martin Slumbers, the CEO of the RNA, right after this from our good friends at Titleist.
The all-new Pro V1 and Pro V1X are designed to outperform. Created in Titleist R&D laboratories, manufactured in Titleist golf ball plants, and then validated by the best players in the world. These golf balls are longer and more consistent with unrivaled control. Outperform with the new Titleist Pro V1 and Pro V1X.
Welcome back to Musings on Golf. Bob, we are a little more than 1 week away from the first ball flying for real at the 151st Open at Royal Liverpool, also known to many as Hoy Lake. And who better to talk about the final major of 2023 than the CEO of the RNA, Martin Slumbers. Welcome to Musings on Golf.
Hello there and welcome. It's a delight to be with you. And gosh, it seems strange to think it's the last major of the year. So it's good to be here.
Hi, Martin. Bob Boepka here. You know, I've covered over 127 majors, but I've always been asked, you know, if I could only do one major, what would it be? And they don't even get the question out before I say Open Championship, nothing compares to it. And it's just fascinating attending an Open Championship. Let me ask you something, Martin. Were you there when Jack played his last at St. Andrews?
Yeah, I was. I actually traveled up, especially the night before, to watch Jack play, and I have one of the £5 notes with his picture on it, and I followed him. I followed the whole way around. If I remember correctly, he played with Luke Donald and Tom Watson, and it was quite extraordinary. And I couldn't get up the 18th; there was so many people there. But I stood by the 17th green and watched Jack walk up, and wonderful piece of history. Yeah, wonderful piece of history.
It really was. And I remember all the players that were on the driving range. They put their clubs down. They went and watched. The people in the buildings across the street were all out on their patios. It was a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to see the home of golf paying tribute to many, and many make the argument the best that ever played the game.
Oh, yes. You know, I think there's something for me. You know, I love watching Tiger play golf. I think he transformed the game. But I suppose I'm of that age where I still think of Jack as the as the greatest player. And, you know, the way he made birdie up 18, he was always going to make birdie up 18.
That's right.
But there's something about St Andrews, you know, and I expect we'll talk a little bit about last year. But this place has got golf in its blood, and there's nothing better than seeing the great champions play and finish their careers here. It's extraordinary. And my first Open that I came to watch was here. It was in 1984 in Seve Ballesteros. And, you know, Seve is my favorite golfer. Not the best, but my favorite golfer.
Why is that, Martin? Why is she your favorite?
I loved the way he played, like, you know, a Spanish matador. Mm-hmm. I loved the look of competition in his eyes. But He played with great flair and, you know, could make the ball, you know, bend to his will. And, you know, it was always sad when, you know, his powers diminished and he wasn't able to do that. But at his peak, you couldn't keep your eyes off him. And he was an amazing, and he, for us, and I always look at it, he was our Arnold Palmer. And I think it's very similar, that sort of really go for it, people's player. I've got some great memories of watching him play golf, and I think the game is sadder for the fact that he's no longer with us.
You know, Martin, what I say about St. Andrews is I could bring a group of people that hate golf, absolutely hate golf, but they'll fall in love with St. Andrews.
Yeah, that's very, very true. And I tell you what, I've just walked up to the town this last week. I was up there, and it's packed. There are so many people here. And you know, and as the game becomes more global, which is something that I care about deeply, you're seeing different nationalities coming to St. Andrews and different age groups. And, you know, I think in an age where sometimes I think we're all a little bit too cynical, I do think even the younger generation get as captivated by this place as the three of us.
Well, let me ask you this. The Open just around the corner now. How is the golf course at Royal Liverpool Golf Club, Hoy Lake, shaping up?
Oh, it's looking really good. It's looking really, really good. We had a very hot spell here about a month or so ago, and the golf course got very brown. You know, we're holding the greens. It got very brown and very bouncy and very fiery, which was lovely, but a bit too early. And then the weather broke. We had a bit of rain. It warmed up, and the golf course a couple of weeks ago had a green tinge to it again. Now we're sort of beginning to dry it out and get it ready to test these guys. I think it'll play bouncy. I think it'll play firm. The rough won't be overly penal, but it will certainly be in their minds on their driving lines. And I think we're in for a real treat. I mean, the last two Opens here, you know, we've had two great champions in Tiger and Rory. And let's see what happens come Sunday.
Have there been any changes to the golf course since Rory won back there in 2014?
Yeah, well, we've made quite a few changes. We've made some changes to make have more people be able to get on to see it and get around the golf course. So we're going to have 260,000 people here this week, which is a significant increase from when we were last here. A little bit smaller than it was at St Andrews last year, but outside of last year, this will be the largest Open we've ever done. But I think the big change, and what will get a lot of attention, and I'm sure there'll be lots of pluses and minuses, is we built a brand new hole at number 17. If you can think through the golf course, how 17 is just around the back of the dunes. And we've moved the green, which was below the dunes playing downhill, and we've moved the green up onto the dunes. And it now plays at 136 yards, up into the prevailing wind, up onto the dune. And then we've reconfigured the finish. So instead of it being the last two opens where the last four holes were par three, par five, par four, par five, we're now going par five, par four, par three, par five. And I think that will create quite a lot of more drama in those closing holes, both being able to attack and also perhaps dropping some shots. So 17, I'm sure, will get a lot of attention, and I think it's a magnificent hole. It looks fantastic, and it'll be very, very interesting to see how these great players take it on.
Well, we're so pleased to be joined by Martin Slumbers, the CEO of the RNA. You know, Martin, each of the four major championships in golf has its own identity. And I don't mean this question to be necessarily naive, but in addition to the Open being the oldest of the four, how do you and the RNA go about promoting the Open to the sports world, and certainly as different from the other three?
Yeah, and I really like the way you use the word different. I mean, we have four brilliant championships, and I think it's great that they're different. We do start with that point that, you know, it's golf's original championship. It's where this all started. All the things that we take for granted today, it all started with the Open back in 1860. And for 150 years, and, you know, I had the privilege of doing it last year on the 18th green here at the Old Course. You know, we've identified the champion golfer of the year, and, you know, in that, there's a lovely story in that phrase, but I think that historical context sets the Open to be different. But the real difference between the Open and everything else is it's links golf, and you know, we would never play it on anything other than a links course. The players don't play links golf very often, and it brings a completely different challenge. And I always think about what I want to see, I want our fans and our spectators to see on TV, is this battle between a player and nature. And, you know, we talk about this sort of the Open has been forged by nature. And I think that's what makes it really different. And, you know, every shot, or so many of the shots, a player can stand there and he can have three or four different ways of being able to play it. You could have three or different ways of being able to run the ball in or pitch it all the way there. And I think that is what captivates everyone's attention, because we don't see it very often. And it's a great challenge for the players. And I love saying to my team when we set the golf course up and work with the greenkeeping staff, who are without doubt the unsung heroes of all these major championships, that what we want to do is set a golf course that allows them to show us how good they are. And I think links golf is perfectly set up for that. And hopefully we'll, as we said, we'll get something bouncy and we get a bit of wind.
You know, Martin, I had the, I had the honor of being at St. Andrews last year, celebrating that 150th anniversary. Were there any special moments from last year's Open Championship that stood out to you?
I mean, I've got a lifetime of memories of that week. But I think, you know, it's a great privilege to do what I do at the Open. There's not many people who get the opportunity. And I think what I really remember is the meeting the great names of our history. And if I think through, there were a couple of events that are still pinch me moments. You know, on the Tuesday, we had our celebration of champions, Tuesday or Monday, I forget now, a year ago, getting old. But the celebration of champions, and we normally just have our male champions, but we changed it this year. We had champions from our women's open. We had our amateur champions, and we had some golfers with disability. And they all played together around number 1 to 17, 18, round the old. And it was a beautiful day, and it was just fantastic to stand there and just watch these from generations of different play go together, chat, have fun, and entertain us. And then, you know, there was this very moving time when Jack Nicklaus was made an honorary citizen of St. Andrews. And as I think you will know, I mean, it's the only time, only the third American to have been given that honor after Benjamin Franklin and Bobby Jones. And to be there and actually to have been talking to Jack for about a year before that about the ceremony and what he was going to say. And, you know, he wanted to know what Bobby Jones said when he was made a free person of the town. And, you know, we got a transcript of Bobby's speech and showed it to Jack. And just watching Jack stand there and deliver it was, I was just extraordinary. And then you move to the next generations, you know, Tiger crossing the Swilkin Bridge. Was he going to doff his cap? Was he going to stop? Who knows? None of us knew. I don't think he knew. But to watch him coming up there with Rory going down the first, yeah, that was in our modern life of golf. That, you know, that's the two generations then passing each other. And then who will forget the final day? I mean, Rory was the hometown favorite. It was noisy, but boy, did Cam Smith play well that day, and his putting was extraordinary. You know, overall, yeah, I think you know, when we set out planning for it, what we wanted to do was make sure that we respected the history of the Open. We respected the importance of that history to all of us who play the game. And, you know, I felt a huge responsibility to make sure that we discharged that respect and showcased the not just St. Andrews and the Old Course, but the Open Championship and, you know, and our wonderful sport. And, you know, I hope the history books write that we did the sport a good thing that week.
Oh, I don't think there's any question that you did. And Bob, you were in attendance when Mr. Nicklaus was honored and talked with Jack afterward. That was a extremely moving time, wasn't it?
Well, to watch Jack deliver his acceptance, I mean, he basically was crying for 45 minutes. I felt so privileged to be in that facility where he was doing it. It's something that I'll never, ever forget. You'll get a kick out of this, Martin. And it had been arranged that I was going to be able to do a one-on-one with Jack after the ceremony. So we go to the adjacent hall, and the people that are organizing Jack said, Bob, he's with his family now. He's got 30 members of his family. Could you wait until he's finished with that before you do your thing? I said, certainly. So they said, why don't you go in this room here and wait, and we'll come and get you when Jack's ready. I open the door, Martin. There's Lee Trevino. There's Gary Player. There's Tom Watson. And I'm saying, wait a minute. They asked me to wait here? I'll spend the rest of my life here.
Yeah, and that night, Bob, we have, as you know, when we're in St. Andrews, we have a past champions dinner, which is very much a closed door, very private. You know, we had... I think that, if I remember correctly, there's 37 past champions were alive at that time, and 32 of them were in the room.
Wow.
And Jack, I'd asked Jack to speak at the end of dinner. And I think that was, you know, again, it's one of those things that it's a great privilege to have been there and see some of the great champions. And you know, the history, time moves on, unfortunately, and we may never see all that group together again, but it was brilliant.
Yeah, it certainly was. You know, when I was brought into the room to do Jack, he says to me, how'd you like that letter I wrote you? And it had been my birthday earlier that year, and he wrote me this, Barbara and Jack wrote me this very nice personal letter. But I was taken aback that's the first thing he wants to know, what I thought of his letter. But, I mean, that is Jack. I mean, he's just an incredible person, and he's married to an incredible lady. They have done so much for golf.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Martin Slumbers, CEO of the RNA, joining us. Martin, we were fortunate enough to have Mike Wan of the USGA join us a few weeks ago and Seth Waugh of the PGA of America back in May. And like them, you were in the business side, the private sector, before joining the RNA, having worked in investment banking for many years, the likes of Salomon Brothers, Deutsche Bank. I know you're a good player, but what was the process that actually led you to be named chief executive of the RNA back in October of 2015?
Seth and I used to work together at Deutsche Bank, so I've known Seth a long time. I was incredibly lucky. I'd done nearly 30 years working in the city, in Wall Street, in the American vernacular, I decided I wanted to retire and move to play full-time amateur golf. I was getting close to being a senior, I hadn't had time to really compete when I was younger. Go to work and all those sorts of things. So I retired to play sort of full-time golf. And that lasted about 5-6 months. And I was bored out of my brain playing golf every day, and it just gives you huge respect to these people who do it every single day of their lives, that they can do that, because I didn't have the patience. And I had a call out of the blue from a headhunter who said to me, was talking about do I want to go back to work, and I said not really, and he said, but what about working in golf? And I said, that sounds rather interesting. They said, well, would you like to interview for to replace Peter Dawson? And I said, I said, not really. I said, because I've never got a chance of being able to succeed Peter.
Those are big shoes to fill.
Yeah, huge. And I my wife had never been to St. Andrews, and so it was a big question mark when we talked about it. But I have to admit that I did the first interview, and that made me determined, saying, actually, this is what I want to do. And it's a complete change of work and lifestyle. But I'm a very competitive person by nature, and I said, right, now I want this job. And it was a very lengthy, very thorough interview process. And, I'm grateful for the board being willing to look at someone who was outside of the golfing world. I wasn't part of the system. I play club golf, it's been the most brilliant experience. I think we are, and the city, I was very fortunate. You work with some really bright people, but for anyone who hasn't worked in sport, there are a lot of really bright people that work in sport, and especially in golf, and some really nice, bright people. And it's a joy to do, despite whatever the ups and the downs. But life has full of lots of ups and downs. But it's a joy to work with them.
You mentioned earlier about the famous phrase of champion golfer of the year. Is there a backstory of how that phrase came to be? And also for you, the first time that you made that announcement at the 2016 Open, what was that like for you to say those words?
I'll do the backstory first. The story goes, 1859, Alan Robertson, who was the acknowledged best golfer in the world, in the world used to be mostly Scotland in those days, but was the best golfer by a long, long way. And he died in 1859. And the group of members of the three clubs, the Honourable Company, the Royal and Ancient, and Prestwick, got together and said, okay, how do we create an event to identify the champion golfer? And that's how it all started. And that's why it is the words that we use at the presentation ceremony have been used by everyone since 1860, exactly the same.
Wow.
The winner, with a score of the winner of the gold medal and the champion golfer of the year.
Yeah.
You know, the crowd know it's coming, and I think the players know it's coming. And I think my experience has been that the winners I've had in my time here, they really they really take seriously the fact that they're called the champion golfer of the year. And they like that, and I think it's a great piece of history. And as to the first time, 2016, I can confess to waking up quite a few nights in a cold sweat, having had dreams that verged on nightmares of me getting the words wrong or the player's pronunciation wrong. And I suppose let's think back, 2016 was Henrik Stenson against Phil Mickelson. And apart from Nicklaus and Watson, that was probably the best championship battle that we've ever had. And, you know, it was pretty, it's an awesome thing to do, to walk on the green with, I think, one of the most famous trophies in sport and say words that have been said 150 times before by your predecessors. And, you know, that's something that I love, I respect, I treat with great humility.
Yeah, in addition to handing over the claret jug, I know that you lead a team there at the RNA, much like we have here in the States in regards to initiatives to get more people to play the game. You talked about being in the streets of St. Andrews and seeing all the different cultures there, if you will. Can you talk just a little bit about the initiatives that the RNA has in regards to pursuing growth of the game, getting more people interested and playing the game?
Yeah, I mean, it's apart from the open week, it's the thing that I'm most passionate about. And, you know, I think we're doing more. There is more being done than ever before. And, you know, we're doing a lot of heavy lifting. You know, we saw an improvement in participation just before COVID, and then there was great benefits during COVID, and we are absolutely determined to not lose that benefit that we got through those very difficult years that we all went through, in terms of and now having more people playing. But what we're doing is slightly different to what we had done before. And you know, I looked at it with my team, and we felt that too many of our initiatives were aimed at people who already played golf. And one of the troubles about golf is that we're very good at talking to each other. But if you really want to grow the game, you've got to focus on the people who don't play golf today and identify why don't they play golf. And some of it is cultural, and some of it is the way golf is played, and some of it is cost and all sorts of things. And so we have our development programs are really focused on, yes, we'd like people who play golf today to play a bit more, but we're really interested in people who don't play golf today and how do we attract them. And we've got a whole group of new RNA ambassadors, you know, Niall Horan and Gareth Bale are two of them, who come from a different world, but they love golf, and they can attract and talk to, through their social media, people who don't play golf today. So that new golfer is a really key part of it. And I think there are two other aspects to it. One is really being able to prove that golf is good for your health, for your physical and mental health. We spend a lot of time working with medical authorities around that. And I think one of the things post-COVID culturally is that we're all a bit more conscious now about our health. And so positioning that proposition, golf proposition, as it's good for you, is really important. And then the final bit, which I'm really passionate about, is if we're going to get more people to play golf, we need facilities that they can go and play at and that are family friendly. And we are building our first facility in Glasgow, on the west coast of Scotland, and it is a community-based family golf facility, very public, and it opens on August 5. And I am really excited about the opportunities that are going to come from it. And if we can make it work, then it will be we'll do others like it. So those are three big themes that we're doing.
Well, you said the word excited, Martin. We certainly are excited about the opportunity to spend some time with you. Rory won in 2014. What was he? At 18 under par. How about a guess from you, Martin, on the winning score for 2023?
You know, I genuinely do not know what the score is. and I don't, I mean, we talk about it. We genuinely don't, I just don't look at, I think I can remember one score in my 8 years, and that was what Henrik shot when he won at Troon. I think it goes back to that thing about Lynx golf. You know, if the wind blows, it's a completely different challenge than if the wind doesn't blow, but the best player will still win. I don't know what the score will be. I do know these guys are very good, and we all work very hard to make the courses enough of a challenge for them. And it's that real balance that keeps me awake at night during the open week about, do you push it hard enough or have you made it too easy? I certainly look at the scoring early on Thursday and Friday and see how many red numbers are going up on the scoring machine in front of me. You know, the real question you're saying is, who do I think is going to win? And, well, I have my heart and I have my head, and I'm going to keep my counsel on both of them, I think, for the moment.
Well, it would be very fitting if Rory would get to win that claret jug. That's for sure. He's so popular everywhere in the world, and this drought has carried on long enough. Well, St. Andrews is a very special place. The golf course is a very special place, and our guest, Martin Slumbers on Musings on Golf, extra special. Martin, thank you so much for your time, and let's have a great Open Championship.
Thank you very much. It's been a great pleasure to talk with you both, and as you say, let's have a great championship.
When you make the best performing golf balls in the world, your biggest competition is yourself. And now the golf ball that sets the standard for every other has raised the bar again. New Titleist Pro V1 and Pro V1X are longer and more consistent with unrivaled control. Outperform with new Pro V1 and Pro V1X. Titleist, the number one ball in golf.
Hey, Bob, that was some great stuff from Martin Slumbers. I'm impressed by him. And it sure seems to me that the RNA is in really good, capable hands with Martin Slumbers.
Yeah, I mean, he was incredible. First of all, we deeply appreciate him taking the time out. You can imagine what his schedule looks like. Mm-hmm. But to be kind enough to share his words with our listeners on Musings on Golf, I thought was fantastic. He is quite an individual. He's certainly one of the top five most powerful men in golf. And he was fun. I took from it. He was actually fun to talk to, and it's something I never thought I would say, but it certainly was reality.
Yeah, I agree. And we thank Martin Slumbers and the good people at the RNA for taking part in Musings on Golf as a part of our lead up again. You're going to be hearing within the next week or so from the great Gary Player, as well as Tommy Roy, the Emmy Award-winning producer of NBC Sports Golf Coverage, as NBC Sports will once again be bringing the Open to American viewers. On behalf of my good friend Bob Bupka, who is not at the Senate subcommittee hearing today, I'm Kelly Elbin. Thanks for joining us on Musings on Golf.